Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you are about to hear was recorded in 2011.
Good evening. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome and thanks for joining us this evening. Alice Hoffman was here 3 years ago to read from The Third Angel, and it's really a great pleasure to welcome her tonight to read from her new book, The Red Garden, the first story of which I have to say just hooked me instantly. She just hit the bestseller list, so we're really happy for her. So thank you to University Bookstore for inviting us to co-present this evening, to the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, and finally to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. This year, the Foundation is celebrating its 30th anniversary. The Library Foundation represents thousands of people in our community who make gifts, large and small, to support our libraries. So to you Foundation donors who are here with us tonight, we want to say thank you very, very much for your support. So now let me turn things over to Anna Micklin from University Bookstore to introduce our special guest. Thanks.
Good evening. I'm Anna Micklin with University Bookstore, and on behalf of University Bookstore and Seattle Public Library, I want to welcome you to our special event tonight with Alice Hoffman for her new book, The Red Garden. So before we get started, I just want to let you know about some upcoming events we're hosting, also in partnership with the Seattle Public Library. On March 1st, T.C. Boyle will be here at the Central Library for his new novel, When the Killing's Done. We're also looking forward to hosting Howard Jacobson for his Booker Prize-winning novel, The Finkler Question, and that's on April 12th. You can find out more about these events and all of our author events at ubookstore.com or by signing up for our e-newsletter. So tonight, I'm delighted to introduce Alice Hoffman. Alice published her first novel at age 21 while studying for an MA in creative writing at Stanford University. She's since gone on to become a best-selling novelist, publishing 29 works of fiction, including Here on Earth, which was an Oprah Book Club pick, Practical Magic, which was adapted into a movie, the New York Times best-selling The Ice Queen, and a collection of books for young adult readers. Her work has been translated into more than 20 languages and published in more than 100 foreign editions. And as you can see just from the table, she's a very prolific writer. Tonight, Alice is here to talk about her newest novel, The Red Garden, a series of connected stories about a small town in Massachusetts. Following the talk, Alice will be available to answer questions and sign books. So please join me in giving a warm welcome to Alice Hoffman.
Thank you. Is that too loud? I want to thank the Seattle Public Library. I've been here two other times and love to be here, and thank you to University Bookstore for also hosting this. Is this a good sound thing for y'all? Okay. The funny thing is, I think very often writers don't know what a book is about until a book is written. And for me, this began as a novel, and then I really was very interested in Richard Brautigan. I was thinking about him a lot because I read him when I was starting out as a writer, loved his work, and I felt like it was really kind of the primary work of the 60s and early 70s. And he had a wonderful book called The Abortion. And really it was about a library where people brought books that they had written. They brought their stories. Instead of taking books out, they brought books to this library. And I just thought, you know, libraries have been really important in my life. And I thought about creating a small town where there was a bookstore where people brought their stories. And I realized after a while that really it was a book of stories, but there were interrelated stories that formed a novel and linked stories. It all takes place in Massachusetts, where I've lived for 30 years. And I feel that, in a way, it's a love letter to Massachusetts. There are historical characters in it that are Massachusetts residents. Emily Dickinson wanders through town. And I give to her a day and a night that I wish that she really had. And then there's a character named John Chapman, who's also known as Johnny Appleseed. And in the Disneyfied version of Johnny Appleseed, you know, he wears like the frying pan on his head. And the real John Chapman was very different. He was, in a way, the original hippie, very spiritual, wouldn't kill any living thing, wouldn't eat anything that had ever been alive. And one of the reasons that he went across the country planting apple trees, which is really interesting to find out, was that he was very interested in hard cider, which he felt produced an ecstatic state, which for him brought him closer to his faith. So it was very fun for me to write this book about Massachusetts. But in the meantime, over the past winter, I have grown to hate Massachusetts. We've had such terrible weather and so many blizzards and so many snowstorms. I can't imagine why anyone would live there. But I have to say that when I was growing up, I grew up in New York, in kind of a suburb, like a Levittown kind of suburb, where every house was the same. And I always had the fantasy of living in a small town. And I was a huge fan of Peyton Place. And I thought, in a way, it is the secret garden, because I thought it would be so great to live in a small town where everybody knew you and you wouldn't be alienated or lonely. And then as I was writing this book, I realized also everybody would know all your secrets. They would know your history. There'd be no place to hide from your neighbors. And some of the people in this book want to escape from their town, and some are outsiders who are looking for a home. I'm going to read you a piece tonight that's kind of in the center of the book, and it's a character who's the narrator's 10 years old, and I really liked her, and she's actually in another story after this one. And I think she's really somebody who does have a secret. And this section is called The Truth About My Mother. It takes place in 1903. My mother began a new life halfway through her own. Such things happened often in our town. Blackwell was deep in Berkshire County, where the weather was mysterious and the people were equally unpredictable. Several of the inhabitants were the descendants of the founding settlers, families who had intermarried often enough so that many of the women had red hair, and the men were tall and quiet and good at most everything. All of the dogs were collies, smart, fast dogs, used to herd cows and sheep. There were new folks in town as well, people headed out west who were stopped by the mountain on their way to Ohio or Colorado. No one knew how many residents had arrived simply because they were running away from something or someone. My mother, for instance, told everyone that she was a school teacher and that she'd been born in Manchester, England, and trained in Boston. She said that her name was Eleanor Book, because that is what she said, that is what people believed. At that point, Blackwell had only a one-room schoolhouse, and my mother taught every age and subject. The town council was happy to hire her when she appeared one day with a small suitcase and no recommendations. She had beautiful handwriting with full, sensuous letters that betrayed her inner nature. She was given the cottage behind the Brady House, the oldest house in town. When she first arrived, she would stand outside in the garden late at night when everyone else was in bed. People thought they were hearing coyotes or one of the dozens of panthers in the woods, but it was my mother standing in the yard crying. It was only Isaac Partridge who lived in the big house. He was nearly 40, a bachelor. My mother wasn't yet 30, and it was possible to tell that she was beautiful, even though she tried her best to hide it. She wore a black coat that covered her figure and tied her hair in a knot so that she might look more responsible. But at night, when she stood in the garden, she looked young. She looked the way she had when she killed my father in Brooklyn. She killed him one April night. We had a house of our own, and we were well off. Money was not the problem. My father worked for the new electrical company. He said in time the whole world would be lit up, and it would all be his doing, and that God would welcome him into a heaven that was lit by electricity. My father wore a suit and tie when he left in the morning, but when he came home in the evening, he was drunk. My mother and I often hid from him in the vegetable cellar, and to me, Brooklyn smelled like the sea and like root cellars. I liked to sit out on the roof and watch the blue horizon and listen to our neighbors, but then at some point, as twilight was falling, my mother would call my name, and we would go down to the cellar, the way some people do in towns where there are tornadoes. Except in our house, my father was the tornado, and it was he we hid from. Sometimes my father brought home women, and we could hear them up in our house, and my mother would put her hands over my ears. Sometimes he'd be sneaky, he'd be silent, and we thought he was in a stupor, sprawled out on the floor, but instead, he'd be waiting for us in the parlor. He did things I won't speak about. We try not to remember his name, but it was William Wentworth, and he was a vice president at the electric company, and he smelled like smoke. We try not to remember what he did to us, but those are the kinds of things that you can't forget. He worked for Edison, whom he called the great man. Electricity was everywhere, like a snake, lighting up the city. In January, it was used to electrocute an elephant in Luna Park in Coney Island. My mother had taken me to see the same elephant the summer before, and we'd fed her peanuts through the bars. Her name was Topsy, a funny name for such an extraordinary creature. She had been noble as she daintily lifted the peanuts from our hands. Now people said that Topsy was difficult and spooky. She had trampled three of her trainers, at least one of them known to be cruel and abusive. He had burned her with cigarettes just for the fun of it, but none of that was in the papers. My father was excited all that week. He was the one in charge. The event would prove that Edison knew more about the dangers of electricity than Westinghouse, whom my father called an upstart. It was a battle of the greats, and in the end, a single creature who didn't even belong among us would be proof that Edison's method of electrifying the world was safe, while Westinghouse was a crackpot with liquid lightning that would fry us alive. Thousands of people came to see Topsy die. My mother thought that the desire to view such anguish was a sign of the innate cruelty of human beings. She and I were not like other people. For one thing, we preferred the dark. In the root cellar, we saw by candlelight. We had no desire to be part of the audience clamoring to see that poor creature die. We went because my father insisted. We were among the crush of onlookers who applauded, eager for the show to start, but we didn't holler or clap our hands, and it was a horrible sight. The elephant was tied up in ropes, hooked to a platform and a post, with wooden sandals that had copper electrodes attached to her feet. We were in the back of the crowd, but for an instant, the elephant looked at me, and her look went right through me. I had to turn away. Later, my mother told me that the elephant's last keeper had been sitting on a bench nearby and weeping. She said she wanted a man like that, someone who understood sorrow, not someone who caused it. After that, things got worse. My mother's true feelings were in her face, and she didn't have to say anything to show how she felt about my father. I wondered if the electricity at Luna Park had seeped into his skin. And that was why his meanness grew, like a charge, burning brighter throughout the spring. He drank and he burned, and we paid the price. We often kept the lights turned off, though ours had been one of the first houses in Brooklyn to be wired. We kept a lantern beneath my bed. My mother killed him on the Tuesday after I turned 10. I had come between them when he was beating her, and then he'd suddenly turned on me. He was slapping me, and he said words I didn't understand, but I knew from the look on my mother's face as she tore me away that something was over and something had begun. My mother and I began to pray, but we prayed for a bad thing, and I wondered if God would welcome us when we stood before him, or if he would turn us out when the time came to face up to who we had been in our lifetimes and what we deserved in the hereafter. One morning, we went to the fish market. We passed by stands of flounder and piles of mussels dredged from the bay, but my mother wasn't there to buy fish. She was thinking about another dish entirely. She turned down an alley where there were factories. She was so beautiful that men were drawn to her despite the plain way she dressed. They spoke to her, and they made offers I didn't understand. She didn't answer. Instead, she sat me down on a bench, and she told me not to move. Even if it became night, even if the morning broke through, I was to stay exactly where I was. She gave me a bundle of my clothes and a satchel with cheese and bread. She said I was to give my name as Sarah Book, if anyone asked, and to say that I was from Manchester, England. That was where her grandmother had been from, and Book had been her grandmother's maiden name. It was still the truth, even though the facts were stretched out like the muslin we use for our needlepoint samplers. She said whatever happened next, she would come back for me. She said she would always be there when I needed her, and I believed her. But I was afraid she might be the one who would need me. How would I know if I stayed on the bench? How could I come to her aid? When she turned to go, I followed her. The streets in Brooklyn were funny and curved. Some of the sidewalks were made of wooden planks that were slippery when it rained. I kept thinking about the elephant, how she had looked at me, begging for something. I should have run to her and cut the ropes that held her, but I stayed and did nothing. Now I saw the elephant whenever I closed my eyes. Her image had been imprinted inside me with the first burst of electricity, and I couldn't think the word Topsy without getting a shiver. It was beginning to rain, a light spring shower. The air shimmered and the sidewalks were slick. My mother stopped at a shop and then she went inside. It was a tannery. When I peered through the window, I saw that my mother was speaking with one of the women who worked there. She took off the pearl brooch that my father had given her in their courting days and handed it over. The woman took it between her teeth and she bit down to tell if it was real gold, and it was. There were boiling vats everywhere, all containing different colors of mixture. The stench of leather was terrible, so I covered my mouth and nose. It smelled like death in there, and that's what it was. My mother came out with the packet she'd paid dearly for. It was poison. She had on her black coat, even though it was a warm evening. She wore it as if it were her armor, her shield, and her sword. The rain washed away the horrid smell of leather. On my birthday, my mother had made me a chocolate cake with sugar frosting, and she told me that 10 was a special year in a girl's growing up, the year when the direction for all the rest of her life would be set. This is what 10 meant to me. I would never sit on a bench and wait for what happened next. I would never look into the crowd, searching for someone to save me. I followed her, but I stayed in the yard when she went into the house. I peeked through the window and I watched as she opened the packet and poured it into the glass. My father liked a stiff drink when he came home, to follow the ones he'd already had at whatever tavern he'd chosen that day. I sat under a mustard plant. I liked the bitter scent. I looked at my legs and I wondered if they looked like a woman's legs, and if it was possible that my father was confused, and that was why he had looked at me that way, and why he'd said the things I knew were bad. My mother had vowed that he couldn't stay away from women, and perhaps he'd forgotten my true age. I crouched there in the twilight, and in the shadows I felt safe. Soon, my father returned. He looked like a rich man after a day's work. My mother was sitting in a kitchen chair. She didn't run for the root cellar or the closet. She looked calm and beautiful and quiet, and that was when I knew she was going to kill him. She had always run away from him before. He went inside and he was a tornado. He did things to my mother I will not speak about. She didn't cry or try to protect herself. He hit her with his belt, which is why she has a line down her face. It's the mark of that day. And when he was done, she offered him a drink. I sat under the mustard bush until he was finished drinking, and I thought there must be another way for men and women to be with each other if people fell in love. I knew I must do as she told me, so I ran back to the bench where she'd left me, and she didn't come for me that night. I ate the bread and cheese she'd given me. Early the next morning, she finally appeared. She looked tired, and she had a suitcase with her. Some people stared because of the mark of the belt on her face, but she said she didn't mind if people stared, as long as they stayed away. We took the ferry to Manhattan, under the shadow of the Williamsburg Bridge, which I hoped to walk across when it was finished. We went to the train station and then went to Albany because it was the next train scheduled. That was how we chose our fate, quickly and ready for whatever happened next. I took my mother's hand, and she laced her fingers through mine. We saw the city fade away and become green fields and forests and blue skies. We got off in Albany, which wasn't much of a city compared with Brooklyn. We stayed one night in a house where rooms were rented out. We could hear people talking all night in the room right next to ours. I heard a woman laugh, and that sound shone through the darkness, brighter than any light. And I was glad we had gotten on that train. So that's the way these two characters come to find their way to the town of Blackwell, Massachusetts, which is the town where everything happens in this book. And there is a garden in the town that in the first section of the book, in the first story, something very tragic happens in a plot of land. And forever after in this garden, whatever's planted there turns red. It doesn't matter if it's green beans or lilacs, everything turns red. And the stories of the past are handed down from generation to generation. The funny thing about this story and the way that I write is that I didn't realize how some of my real life seeped into the story until I was finished. And for me, stories are kind of like dreams. And, you know, sometimes when you wake up, you remember pieces of a dream, but you sometimes don't know what they mean until much later on, and you'll remember bits more, you know, days or weeks later. And part of what formed this particular story was I had been doing research for a book set in New York in the early 1900s, and I had read about this elephant being electrocuted at Coney Island, which is a true story. And then also, I think it resonated for me because my grandfather was one of the first electricians in Brooklyn. And so there was a lot of talk about electricity in our family. And I didn't really remember that until the story was written. One of the things that happens in this book is that family history becomes mythology and is handed down story after story. And I at first did a family tree, but the family tree was so complicated that it became a town tree, and everyone was so interrelated. And I wanted to have it in the book, but my publisher decided that it might be more fun for readers to figure it out themselves and to figure out how people were related to each other. So anyway, that's The Red Garden and how it begins, and I'd love to take any of your questions, anything you want to ask me about writing or about this book or about Oprah. Yeah. Thank you. It's interlinked stories. It's interlinked stories. It's not a novel, really, but some people call it a novel in stories because really it's about one town and everyone is so related. But I think one of the reasons that I love linked stories is because as a reader, I think I was about 13 or 14, I read this brilliant book written by Ray Bradbury, who's one of my favorite writers and who's turning 90 this year. It was called The Illustrated Man. And it's a great book, and it was really mind-blowing for me. I'd never read anything like it. And if you don't know it, it's a tattooed man, and every tattoo is a story. And then there's kind of a skeleton, or maybe where there's a story in the present, but it always goes back to these linked short stories. And that I always wanted to write a book like that. And I've written two others, one called Local Girls, and another called Blackbird House, which is all set in a farmhouse on Cape Cod. So I think I might know bits and pieces of what the person seemed very confused about what it was, and I think it's because the publisher didn't say stories on the cover. I think if it had said stories, they would have understood. But you know, it's not exactly stories; it's more than stories. So I think it was complicated for that person for some reason, but I don't really know. But thank you. Yeah, it's called. The Town. Oh, I love The Town. The Town is great. And I love Ben Affleck. I think he's a great director. I think he's terrific. You know, the thing about whether you use real people or real incidents is an interesting question. And I always think there are two kinds of writers, fiction writers. I mean, there are probably 200 kinds, but basically two. And there are those who want to write about their lives and use characters from their lives, and I think that's fine. And then there are those who want to escape from their lives. And I'm more of the escapist type. I was as a reader always. That's why I think I was drawn to fantasy and science fiction and fairy tales and folk tales. I'm interested in all alternate worlds, really. And as a writer, I'm interested in creating an alternate world. But of course, as a writer, you're always bringing yourself along with you. I mean, there's no way to really escape yourself and your experience and your reading and everything else. So it is a complicated thing. Definitely. Well, I think, you know, for me, it's kind of like I was a reader before I was a writer, and I was the kind of person that always had a book with me, like as many readers do. So I think for me, it's just a transition from being a reader to being a writer. And I think, you know, for me, it's an escape, just the way reading is for a lot of people and always was for me. So, you know, I've also been doing it for a long time. I've been doing it for 30 years, so I have a lot of books because I've been doing it for a long time. Thank you. Yeah. Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's an interesting question. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Is there a character in one of my books that I feel more for or feel is more like me? You know, for me, I kind of feel in a way my characters are all like me, including the dogs and the bears. I feel like what the truth is for me is that it's like there's a mirror, and I throw it on the floor, and it breaks into 1,000 pieces, and every one of those little pieces is one of my characters. And, you know, I always, there's something in everybody I write about that I can relate to. It feels a little bit like me, but different. And I think, you know, I'm different as a writer than I am as a person. I think I'm much more positive as a writer than I am as a person. And I think someone asked me an interesting question. She said, you know, when you write, are you writing because you want answers to certain questions? And I realized that was true. And that's part of, I think, why I write so much, is that I have a lot of questions and I don't have the answers. And I'm writing to find out what those answers are. But thank you very much. I really appreciate your support. Thank you. Well, I just want to thank you, first of all, for turning your friends onto my books. I really appreciate that, because I think you find out about the writers that you love from your friends. And thank you. I really appreciate that. I think it's really important to share books, and it means a lot when you share it with someone. I think that I might suggest that they start with a book that I wrote a long time ago called Turtle Moon, which is a big favorite of a lot of my readers, and I think it's a good story and very emotional, and I think that's what I would recommend. Yeah. More or less, am I finding there's more or less magic in literature or in life? Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question, because I don't plan out, you know, am I using magic more or less? I don't plan it out. It just kind of seeps into the work. And I think, you know, you're so influenced, I think, by what you read as a child. And as a child, I read folk tales and fairy tales, and I had a Russian grandmother who told me stories. And as I grew up, I started to read a lot of fantasy and science fiction, read Ray Bradbury, Shirley Jackson, and I think I was very influenced by those writers. And I feel, I've come to believe that that literature always includes magic, you know, whether it's mythology or folk tales, or I think it's really kind of the oldest way of storytelling and the original storytelling. It's interesting because now I think in publishing there's a lot more magic than when I started out, and it's a lot more mainstream. It used to be genreized a lot more and not thought of as literature, and I think that has really changed, which is a good thing, I think. Oh, no, I didn't take it that way. No, I didn't take it that way at all. I mean, I, as a reader, I love magic, and I love all different kinds of literature, but I always feel like it's the original storytelling. Thank you. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, in the first story in The Red Garden, It's about the original settlers, the founding families of this town. And there is a woman who has kind of a relationship with a bear. And there are a lot of stories that are in this that are based on fairy tale motifs. And there are a lot of animal groom and animal bride fairy tales where, you know, who's a beast and who's human is very difficult to tell who's who. And so there is a bear in this story. And people, actually, the book is very much about how nature changes us and how we change nature. And I was thinking about this because the other day I was watching something, I think it was on the Today Show, and they had done a survey to see if your house was burning down, who would you save first, your spouse or your pet? And 70% of the people said their pet. So I felt like, you know, people have very close relationships with animals. And that's kind of the beginning of the story and the beginning of the mythology of the town. Yeah. Pandora. Hello. Nice to meet you. She doesn't have a name. Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because the first novel that I ever wrote, which was called Property Of, the character also didn't have a name. And in a way, I felt like the Ice Queen was that character grown up. And both of those books are really about people who have no self. They don't feel... They have no ego, they have no self, they don't know who they are, they're searching for their inner self and their inner strength. And The Ice Queen is a story about a woman who's struck by lightning, and she's a survivor. And it's kind of a fairy tale motif of when she's struck by lightning, actually she changes and she can't see the color red. And I didn't realize what I was writing about until I finished the book once again, and that is I'm a breast cancer survivor, and so I think I very often am drawn to writing about women who survive and women who triumph over loss and adversity, and also, this is really my life seeping into my book, is that in my family, instead of talking about emotions, we talked about weather. It was like, we'd have a lot to talk about this winter, but, and my brother actually became a meteorologist, like the character's brother in the novel, so. And I think it really is just a book about her trying to find herself and find out who she is. Good. Yeah, I think it should feel natural that you feel like you know her so well you don't even have to know her name. And I thank you so much. It's nice to be friends with you on Facebook. And I think it's great when people can share books together. And I think it's great that you and your sister and your mother do that. Thank you for coming. Well, you know, it's funny because Here on Earth was my Oprah book. And it's kind of my homage to my favorite book, which is Wuthering Heights. I love that book. And I think it's such an... Yeah, you're right. I wrote an introduction to Wuthering Heights. And I think it's... One of the things that I really like about that book is that when you read it at different times in your life, when you read Wuthering Heights, like if you read it when you're a very young girl, let's say, you feel like Heathcliff is a great romantic hero. And then you read it when you're an older person and you think Heathcliff's a crazy lunatic. And then you read it when you're a little older and you think Heathcliff is very complicated. And I had to give a talk in Washington, and it was a bunch of writers talking about first loves, and I wrote about Heathcliff. And in the audience, this is just between us, in the audience was Hillary Clinton, and she was nodding her head like she totally got it. We know who her Heathcliff is. Yeah, and right now, actually, I've just finished a new book. And so I'm very involved in, even though The Red Garden has just come out and, you know, I'm involved with that. I'm very involved with this new book that's coming out actually in October that I've been working on for the past 5 years. That's a very different book for me, but very much about magic and about survival. It takes place in 70 AD during the fall of Jerusalem and at Masada, which was a mountain attacked by Romans where the Jews who were there committed suicide rather than become slaves. And what I didn't know until I started to research the book was that there's only one historian, Josephus, he's the only one who's told any of these stories, was that two women and five children survived that night. And this is my book is their story. So that has been really keeping me busy. really different. But I think you'll like it. Yeah.
Speaking of Here on Earth, this is a question.
Yes. Okay. No, an Oprah question, sorry. It's an interesting question. You know, I think the people who were first-time writers, and it was their first novel, and they were in Oprah, I think their lives were really changed. I think I had so many books by the before I went on Oprah, and I think it was more. I think it introduced my work to people who didn't know about it and wouldn't have known about it if Oprah hadn't put it in her book club. And I think she introduced a lot of writers whose voices wouldn't have been heard otherwise, especially at the beginning, of women writers, of minority writers. I think she was great at that. It was a very intense experience, and I was a nervous wreck. And before I went, I was friendly with Wally Lamb, who had been on the show and who's a wonderful writer. And I called him and asked him, what it was like. And he said, don't worry, you won't have to say too much. Which was true. And she was so great. You know, she had no notes. She had, no earpiece. She had nothing. She remembered everything about me, my book, and also we had lunch with a couple of women who had life experiences that were like the book. You know, they had experienced, terrible romances or had, very much their personal lives. And she remembered everything about them as well. And after the lunch, one of the women kind of went racing up to her and knelt down beside her. It was kind of like, for a second, a scary moment. Nobody knew it was going to happen next. And she said to Oprah, "I always wished that you were my best friend." And it was really sweet. And Oprah said, "I get a lot of people tell me that." And I think that's really true, is that she feels that way, especially with the book club, is that she was the friend who kind of introduced you to writers that you wouldn't have known otherwise. So for me, it was a great experience, and I think she's done a lot for books. The story of Here on Earth is kind of an homage to Wuthering Heights, where I took some of the themes and the motifs in that book and put them into modern times to see how that would work out. It didn't work out too well for the characters, but it was very interesting to do, and I would never want to do it again because I had to adhere to certain things that I usually have much more freedom. Yeah. When I start a book, do I have a theme in mind? I think I do, or I don't know if it's a theme, but I feel like I have a story, I have a plot, or I have a character, and that just kind of builds, and I make notes, and I write down kind of attributes of the character, and trees and flowers that might be in that landscape, and then I make an outline usually. But really, what happens is when I start to really write, it all just happens. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know what happens, but it kind of comes alive in the writing. And sometimes, people say in order to find the story, you have to really write your way into it. And I think in a way that's true. And I also think the more you write, the easier it gets. Every time I start a new book, I forget what it's like to write a book, and I have to relearn it. I always think, who wrote those other books? I don't know how to do it. And, it's just a learning process every time. It's hard. When they made the film of Practical Magic, I didn't really have anything to do with it, but I had been a screenwriter in Hollywood for 25 years, and that helped me to support my novels when I was starting out. So I knew that it was not going to be the book. The thing about that movie is I love the women who were in it. They are so great. It's Sandra Bullock, Nicole Kidman, Stockard Channing, Diane Wiest, Evan Rachel Wood. I mean, it's just an amazing cast. But one of the things that happened in that movie, and I like a lot about that movie, is that there were three writers. And it just kind of, I think it just didn't coalesce. I think it feels like there was more than one writer. And, what Hollywood does things in such a different way. One of the things they did with the book, it's about sisters who come from a line of witches in Massachusetts. One of the things they did, instead of doing research or going to the library or calling me or something, they hired a witch as a consultant, and they didn't like her. So they fired her and they didn't pay her. And after that time, everything went wrong on that set. I mean, really, things were falling apart like crazy. And one of the other things they did that I personally would never have done was they tried to do realistic magic spells. I mean, I always felt like you know, I used real some real ingredients, but I never wanted to do anything that, you know, a 12-year-old girl might, you know, kill her dog with or anything like that. And there were two crimes that were committed because of the movie, using the magic from the movie. In one, a woman actually tried to kill her husband and it didn't work and she was arrested. In the other, a woman broke into Brad Pitt's house with some kind of magic spell that she thought was in the movie, and she was also arrested, and it didn't work. So it was a whole different attitude, you know, about the subject matter. But in the end, I think it's a fun movie. I think it could have been even better, but you know, I love the women who are in it. Oh, this is about my book, The Third Angel, and it takes place in the 60s, and there's a girl named Lucy who's on a train. You know, when I finish a book, I kind of forget a book. It's really an interesting thing. I think I know, somebody just told me that Meryl Streep was interviewed, and she said that as soon as she finishes one movie, she completely forgets that movie. She forgets the character, the lines, everything, and she goes on to the next thing. And I also kind of forget it, but you don't really want me to tell you the answer to that. Do you? See, I think I think because reading is so interactive, I think it's what you think it is, and I think some things it's better not to know from the author. It's really it becomes the reader's book, and it becomes, you know, what you want it to be. So if that's what you want it to be, I'm with you. Thank you. That was fun because I got to write about London in the 60s, and I had always, in the 60s, all I wanted to do was go to London, and I didn't really want to be a writer. I just wanted to marry Paul McCartney. And so that was really fun to write. Thank you very much. Illumination Night was a book that I wrote about Martha's Vineyard, and the funny thing for me was that when I wrote it, I'd never been to Martha's Vineyard. And I had a great writing teacher, a great mentor named Albert Gerard, and actually this book is dedicated to him, and there's a little photograph of him as a boy in Paris. It's a really great photograph. And he always said, you know, you don't have to write what you've experienced. You just have to write what you're able to feel. And I think that's really true. And but after I finished the book, I did go to Martha's Vineyard, and I went to Illumination Night just to make sure it was the way I thought, and it was so beautiful. And thank you. Thank you very much. I'm glad you liked the book. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Thank you for saying that, because, you know, the sad parts really get to me too, as a reader and as a writer. Wait till you read the next book. It's really sad. Because I think, you know, it's kind of, you really experience something when you feel those emotions. And I, you know, I remember especially as a child reader, you know, how influenced I was by feeling the emotions from a book. And it becomes such an interactive thing. So thank you very much. Thank you all for being here tonight. I really appreciate it. I appreciate all your kind words. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.